Hi, I'm Edwin King, Kentucky Housing Corporation's Executive Director, and today we're starting part two of our first ever podcast here at strategichousing.com with our guest, Mark Shelburne, Senior Manager with Novogradac & Company. As I mentioned before, Novogradac & Company is a nationally recognized organization for their expertise with the low-income housing tax credit program, closing those transactions and guiding clients through business issues of the tax credit program. Mark specifically consults with state agencies, local governments, financial institutions, and developers on topics including allocation policy, supportive housing, IRS compliance, program innovation, and fair housing. In our last podcast, we were talking about the importance of the Qualified Allocation Plan, or the QAP, to Kentucky and some of the changes that KHC is making to improve the process and reduce red tape. Mark, what do you see as the most important goals low-income housing tax credit administrators should have in developing the qualified allocation plans and establishing LIHTC program policies?
Well, the obvious answer that still needs to be said is to make certain that the policies fit with the particular state needs. And there are certainly specific ways to think about that and look at that if it's a state, for example, with declining population, then it may make more sense to have a greater share of the resource go towards rehabilitation than may be appropriate in the state where the population is booming and thus is more in need of new construction. And so those are really the considerations, and that's the main consideration. And that's part of the genius of the program, is allowing states to make those decisions. Less obvious is the need to be certain the QAP fits with the capacity of the staff and board to implement. And this can vary on a number of bases. There's expertise, political support, and other considerations that need to be taken into account before deciding which policies to have and how to get implemented. One that stands out to me that doesn't really get talked about very often, but I think is important to keep in mind, is the extent to which the agency is able to implement its judgment, the extent to which it's able to apply subjective criteria. And in some cases, that can make a lot of sense and can be a good approach. In other circumstances, it doesn't work quite as well. And again, that varies based on the abilities of the staff and the support from the board and the role with the rest of state government. And I guess the other important goal is one that we discussed on the last podcast, which is that agencies always need to continue to seek to improve their processes and outcomes. And that's just fundamentally crucial. It, like with everything in life, anything that someone does can be done better. And that's absolutely essential. There's a great quote that was inaccurately attributed to Charles Darwin, which says that it's not the strongest or the smartest species who survive. It's the ones that are the best able to adapt. And I guess I would rephrase that to say it's adapt and improve. And again, that's something that agencies need to always keep in mind.
Great. Well, what are some of the policies you have seen implemented in other states that have been particularly interesting or successful?
The ones that stood out to me in thinking about this is what first got started in Indiana and has since been replicated in Tennessee, which is having what they call innovation rounds. And there's obviously any number of ways you could phrase it, but the basic idea is, after going through the regular application cycle and looking at the, again, two-thirds to three-fourths of projects that didn't get funded, are there ones among those that are truly meritorious, that really need to move forward and happen for some unique reason, but for other reasons didn't happen to fit the state's criteria to succeed in the scoring? And it's a recognition that it's impossible, really, for any, even the most informed well thought out set of policies to anticipate in advance all the different possible proposals that can come to it. And so these innovation rounds allow those projects to move forward on a subsequent application cycle and to be considered using different criteria. And so the state can avoid missing out on an opportunity, can be certain to move something forward that will have a tremendous impact that, again, wasn't recognized earlier. And so I think that those states are wise to have that as part of their process. And actually, I should note that back in 2014, when Indiana first did this, the executive director there, a friend of mine, Jake Sipe, was kind enough to invite me to participate in that. And it's been going ever since. And again, Tennessee had their first round just this last year. And so I think that's a great approach. The other that I would say is whenever another policy that states have implemented is not so much one, but just an overall concept, is in any instance where the state has teamed up and partnered with a in-state academic, where they're working with a university to try to think of better ways to implement their policies. The couple of examples that come to mind are Ohio and California are working with state universities there in their states to think of ways to allocate their credits, in particular what are opportunity areas. And so there certainly are a few other examples along those lines, but in my opinion, there really ought to be more, because the academic community has a great deal of capacity and knowledge, data, and intelligence available that ought to be applied to the distribution of credits.
Great. Well, just to piggyback on a couple of things you said there, you mentioned Jake in Indiana and what they're doing in housing, and I serve on the board there with Jake, the NCSHA board, and he really is doing a lot of innovative things in housing in Indiana. It's certainly a model for us here in Kentucky to look up to. And with regard to the university piece, I would say for our listeners, Kentucky Housing Corporation is actually in the process of completing a needs assessment across the state, and we've partnered with the UK Gatton School to conduct that needs assessment. So we really want to be data driven here in Kentucky housing, and the University of Kentucky is really going to help us in that regard. Mark, have you had an opportunity to review some of the recommendations from the National Council of State Housing Agencies about best practices for LIHTC administration? I know we just passed those back in December. Have you had a chance to look at those?
I have. Actually, my history with the recommended practices goes back quite a ways. In 2010, the previous version of half of the practice, the current practices, the allocation underwriting half, went through a revision, and my then boss, Bob Kukab, was one of the co-chairs of the committee leading that effort. And so I got to be involved, had a front row seat for that previous set of amendments. And so obviously when this, the current set came out, I was not with an agency, and so wasn't as closely connected to the work as those of you who are, but NCSHA very appropriately sent out an early draft of the practices in the summer of 2017 to a variety of industry groups, including my firm. And so in Novogradic, as some of you listening may know, has a working group. And so we considered the comments, and we also were in touch with other similar organizations and groups and companies across the country. And And the purpose for NCSHA sending that draft out was to solicit comments. And so we were among the many who did send in comments. And then I was pleased to see the final version that that came out very recently for many reasons, one of which was that, again, it incorporated a lot of that input that came in. And and I would also like to commend NCSHA on having the ability to step back and realize that their previous practice of having two distinct set of practices between the allocation underwriting versus compliance and asset management was an unnecessary and artificial divide. And so they were able to step back again from that, what had been that divide, and bring them together in the new document. So it contains all four components, which I think is excellent. And so I would commend NCSHA and its members, particularly those who served on the task force, for its work along those lines. It was no doubt difficult, and no one paid anyone for all that work, but it's important for the program for it to have happened.
Great. Well, now, are you of the opinion that every state should comply entirely with the recommendations from NCSHA?
No, and the recommendations themselves actually recognize that isn't necessarily the best approach. But I would say that wherever an agency has some deviation from the practices, it ought to be an instance of reflection and consideration of why there is that difference. And it could be that upon doing that careful thinking and analysis, the agency decides, well, maybe we really should be more in line with this national practice. But conversely, it could be there's a good reason for having the difference in distinction. Right.
Moving on, we are seeing a lot of escalating construction costs in Kentucky, much like most of the country, really. And as you know, the LIHTC program has come under scrutiny in recent years regarding costs and other issues. What are your thoughts about the effects of escalating costs on the program, and how do we address these issues?
So whenever speaking about this topic, I like to try to encourage people to consider the question of costs in two different ways. On the one hand, there's the need to take into account for every application that comes in what it's proposing for the development budget, and looking at the line items and seeing which ones may be too high or in some cases may be too low, and how to best estimate what those are going to be. And so, for example, most developers will note that the costs could be lower if across the board, if states were to have less demanding design criteria or fewer green requirements. And so those sorts of questions fall into that category. Another way to look at that is what I understand to be the practice in Minnesota, which is to actually do a sophisticated analysis of the proposals relative to look at what the application is to build, and then compare it to what the cost would be if looking at various estimators. I don't know the details and specifics, but from what I have heard of that, it sounds like an innovative way to do the analysis. And I think that agencies ought to do more of that sort of thinking, because right now the process is, in the vast majority of states, is pretty much entirely developer driven. They will think about what numbers to submit, and then agencies will decide how much of that information they accept and then move forward. But developers, appropriately, their first consideration has to be what set of numbers that I propose will give me the best chance of getting funded. And that's not always going to be the last consideration. They may have other aspects that overlay that those choices. But having a set of numbers for a project that doesn't get funded is not helping them. And so agencies really need to, I think, get more involved in the process of determining what are logical, appropriate costs for properties during the application phase. So that's the one type of consideration. The other type of consideration is making certain to not fund properties that meet the headline test, that are so costly as to be newsworthy. And that dollar amount varies tremendously across the country. It even varies within certain states. But agencies as a whole have an obligation to the program to not let those properties go forward, even though in many cases they could be entirely meritorious. They could have great reasons for why they cost more. But the problem is those reasons don't get heard in many circumstances. The elected official looks at the number, sees the costs, and draws an immediate conclusion. And all of a sudden you've lost a supporter, potentially an important supporter. And that individual doesn't necessarily even hear about the positive reasons for why the project costs more, let alone care about them. So those are the two ways I always encourage people to think about costs.
Great, Mark. Well, thank you again very much for participating in this second podcast. And for our listeners, as a reminder, for the QAP process, we've scheduled a forum for the 30th of January from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Kia Building at 100 Airport Road here in Frankfurt. We'll likely have another forum in February, and that date is to be determined. We also anticipate holding a public hearing in March, and hopefully we have the QAP to our board of directors in April. So, Mark, thank you again for participating. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be a participant at all, let alone in the first two podcasts.